morning and welcome to the second day of our term down at the University of South Dakota. For those of you in attendance, we have several publications which you might wish to pick up. They're available free in the lobby if you already haven't gotten them. We have a photographic history of the South Dakota Supreme Court. We also have a blue-covered book which explains in written form how the Supreme Court decides cases and how we work. And then also we have a synopsis in this publication of the 9 cases which we will hear on oral argument for this term. It also tells you a little bit about ourselves and, once again, how the system works. We would like to note and welcome this morning students from the Unique Learning Experience School, Baltic High School, the T High School, the Law School of the University of South Dakota, and students from the University of South Dakota, Western Dakota Tech, and McCrossin's Boys Ranch. The first case for oral argument this morning is Doe versus Nelson. Justice Zinner has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Tim Tucker, a circuit judge from Madison, to sit in his place. My understanding is that, for the appellants will be Mr. Lawrence Long, Attorney General of the State of South Dakota. You will speak for 15 minutes. Is that correct, sir? Any objection, Mr. Wilkham?
No, Your Honor.
Very well, then you'll have the 20 minutes, Attorney General Long. For the appellees, Doe would be Mr. Thomas Wilkham, an attorney from Sioux Falls. With that, Attorney General Long, you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, good morning. I am Larry Long. I'm the Attorney General of the State of South Dakota, and I appear here on behalf of Chris Nelson, who is the Secretary of State. Since 1889, when the South Dakota Constitution...
You just lost 5 minutes of your time.
Well, we'll revert to the prior situation, Your
Honor. Very well.
Since 1889, when the South Dakota Constitution was adopted, the word pardon has appeared in the South Dakota Constitution.
Excuse me, Attorney General, are the lights working, Madam Clerk? One more time, if you
okay.
Please.
In 1889, the voters of South Dakota placed the power to grant pardons with the governor of the state of South Dakota under processes established by the legislature. And that was the law for many years. At the same time, in 1890, the next year, the South Dakota legislature defined a pardon as a public record and declared that it would be open for public inspection. In 1960, the South Dakota Constitution was amended and combined the power to pardon between the governor and the parole board. But again, a pardon was still a public record. In 1972, the South Dakota voters a third time amended the South Dakota Constitution and removed the relationship between the governor and the legislature and the parole board and granted the governor much unrestricted power to pardon, but still, pardons were public records. Now, in 1978, the South Dakota legislature authorized the governor to delegate power through executive order to the parole board to assist him in processing pardon applications. But the process that was defined was still a public process, and powers to grant and orders granting pardon were still public records. In 1983, that process was further modified, and the South Dakota legislature adopted SDCL 24-14-11, which stated in pertinent part that if a pardon is granted pursuant to the processes established by the Board of Pardons and Paroles, then in the event a pardon is granted pursuant to that process, the governor shall order that all official records, including the orders granting pardon, shall be sealed. Since 1984, all orders granting pardon that have been filed with the Secretary of State's office have contained sealing language referencing SDCL 24-14-11. In early 2003, the Secretary of State was asked for copies of all the pardons issued since 1995, and he asked for an opinion of this office with reference to which pardons were public and which pardons were not. On February 14th of 2003, my office issued an opinion, and my office opined that SDCL 24-14-11 authorized the governor to seal orders granting pardon only if the public process described in 24-14 had been followed. And if that process had not been followed, then those records were not subject to or protected by the governor's power to seal, and they were open to the public under the general rule. Now, we're in court today because several persons who received pardons outside of the Board of Pardons and Paroles process, outside of the process defined in 24-14, were concerned that those pardons would be made public, and they retained Mr. Wilka, who appears on their behalf today. A hearing was held on the litigation that Mr. Wilka filed on behalf of his clients in front of Judge Severson in Sioux Falls. And he made several findings, all of which I submit are in the operative ones I submit are in error. And he in effect found that as a result of the 1972 amendments to the South Dakota Constitution, the authority to issue pardons was reposed in the governor.
And Mr. Attorney General, those are really not findings, those are legal conclusions, correct? So we would read.
You're correct, Your Honor. I'm reading from the conclusions of law. I'm reading from paragraphs 13, 14, and 15 of the.
And I'm sure Mr. Welker can correct me if I'm wrong, but there is no argument here on the facts. I mean, it's virtually stipulated, isn't it?
No, the facts are not in dispute,
Your Honor. All right.
This is a legal question. And in essence, the court reached the legal conclusion that the power to pardon is so vast and so plenary and so reposited in the governor that neither the legislature nor the courts have any power to interfere or to define that issue. Now, I submit that there is a separation of powers issue in this case, but it's not the one that the trial court identified. The separation of powers issue in this case results from the failure of the trial court to define the word grant and to define the word pardon. One of the things that we learned from Poppin versus Walker is that, like the word lottery, the word grant and the word pardon are constitutional terms that the legislature is powerless to define. Likewise, in contrast with what the lower court decided, the governor is powerless to define either those words. In other words, the governor has the power in unfettered discretion to grant a pardon. He does not have the power to define the nature or the scope of what a pardon is. That power is left to the voters of South Dakota, and if there's any question about the nature and extent of the word pardon, that decision has to be made by the courts of this state. That is the fundamental job of the courts of this state, and the trial court and this court cannot abdicate that responsibility to the governor. Now, in the cases that we have cited, other courts have dealt with very similar problems. And I would point the court, first of all, to the case of Noonan, which is a federal court case. Incidentally, the language in the South Dakota Constitution, which gives the governor the power to grant pardons, is almost identical to the language in the U.S. Constitution, which gives the president the power to grant pardons. And in dealing with that language, the federal courts were faced with a question involving Mr. Noonan, who had applied for and received a presidential pardon as a result of violation of the Selective Service Act. He was a conscientious objector and had been prosecuted and convicted for basically avoiding the draft during the Vietnam War. He asked for and received a presidential pardon from President Carter and then asked for the expungement of his records. And he basically argued to the court that the power to pardon, and in fact, the granting of the pardon was, and the inherent nature of a pardon was sufficiently large to wipe out the guilt, or basically place him back in the situation that he was in prior to having committed the conduct. And in a detailed analysis, the court dealt with that issue head on and concluded that the word pardon and the power of the president to grant a pardon was not so large as to encompass that type of expungement of his records and expungement of his conduct. The court said, among other things, that the power to pardon is an executive prerogative of mercy, not of judicial record keeping, and they drew a distinct line between the power to pardon and the power to determine which records ought to be expunged and which ones ought not to be expunged. But the court took the issue head on of defining a pardon and determining what it meant, which was a core function, I believe. The other case that we've cited in our brief is People versus Thone, T-H-O-N, which is an Illinois case. And in that case also, a former convict who had received a gubernatorial pardon asked for his records to be expunged. And he again argued, and the trial court concluded, that inherent in the power to pardon, or the power inherent in the word pardon, was the elimination or the cleaning of the record as if this individual had never committed the conduct that for which he received the pardon. The appellate court found that the governor is constitutionally empowered to grant pardons in Illinois, but by contrast, the power to expunge records is controlled by statute. Thus, an individual is eligible for expungement only where the legislature has authorized expungement. Now, and the problem with the lower court in this case is that that analysis was never done. The trial court, in my view, simply assumed that broad definition and assumed that very large, all-encompassing theory of the word pardon, and assumed that the governor had the unfettered discretion to make that decision. We believe he does not.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that that the legislature has the right, if they saw fit to do it, is to permit all pardons to be sealed?
One of the statements in the Thone decision, Your Honor, is that the legislature has the power to grant rights to a pardoned individual over and above those encompassed by the word pardon, but the governor does not.
What I'm troubled with, the power is in the people, and the legislature are the representatives of the people. And if the people have a right to know about a crime being committed, and it's a public offense, and you as Attorney General prosecute that crime for the benefit of the people, then how does the legislature, as a representative of the people, do they have the power to pardon if they saw fit to do so? To allow the governor to use a procedure where it's not only pardoned but sealed? And then if so, what is the people's remedy? Just to elect new officials to represent them?
The governor can grant a pardon. That's clear in the Constitution.
Right.
What the governor cannot do is determine the breadth of what a pardon is, because that decision was made by the voters, and the definition of the word pardon has to be made either by the trial court or by this court. Neither the legislature nor the governor can make that decision. I believe that, unless the Constitution otherwise prohibits it, that the legislature can grant rights to the pardoned individual over and above those encompassed in the ordinary definition of the word pardon.
Okay, and then you're saying that the people's remedy would be to get new representatives by an election.
Well, the people, if the people are unhappy, for example, with 24-14-11, they can They can attack the law by referral. They can attack it by an initiative to repeal it. They can run for the legislature and get it repealed in that fashion if they're unhappy with that legislative process, as they can with all laws. But I don't think the governor can do that. The governor is bound by whatever this court says the word pardon means.
When the legislature passed the 24-14-11, the effect of that is to actually have a dual system, where if you are pardoned, under your theory, wherein you are pardoned by the governor, it is public record, and if it goes through the Board of Pardons, then it would not be. Is there any reason, or do you, in your research, did the legislature contemplate a dual system when they passed this, or did they assume that the governor had the power to seal the pardons that he would give?
Well, I don't honestly know. I don't believe that the governor even thought that he had the unilateral power to seal these pardons, because the pardons themselves reflect and refer back to 24-14-11. I think that is that's a conclusion that the trial court reached, but no one else ever had. Historically, they've always been public records.
You have approximately 1 minute, sir.
Okay.
Just for the record,
yes.
These pardons now that we're talking about are still in the Secretary of State's office, is that correct?
That's correct.
And they are still sealed?
Correct.
They have not been provided to this court, and you have not been able to see them or see what their contents are either.
There's been a writ issued, and we believe, in compliance with the writ.
So the remedy you're asking for is that those pardons be unsealed?
Well, those that were not issued in compliance with 24-14-11.
Right.
Yes. My time has expired. I do not mean to waive any arguments that I've addressed in my brief that I've not addressed here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Mr. Arneson, you have 5 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Court, I apologize for being late. You think after a year of having this case in the hopper, I would have written down 9 o'clock instead of 10 o'clock. I'm glad I intended to get here an hour early. I'm here representing a group of media who were allowed to appear at the original hearing in this case in the trial court, or at least file a brief as amici. And we have also been permitted by this court to appear here, and the Attorney General has kindly given up 5 minutes of his time for us to present our position on this. We do concur with the briefs and arguments that the Attorney General has made, and philosophically are in accord on the issues of the history of the law, the separation of powers, which we do not believe is an issue in this case. Our basic argument is this. The trial court had before it a 1972 constitutional provision, Article 4, Section 3, that said the governor may grant pardons. From that, he inferred a corollary power to keep those pardons sealed. Now, nothing in the history up to that time had kept pardons sealed, and nothing since. In fact, throughout all these transitional phases that both Mr. Welker, the Attorney General, and I have briefed on the Constitution, the most important being the 72 change, through all those transitions, the Secretary of State was to be taking as the official acts of the governor, attesting them, filing them, and keeping them open for public inspection under SDCL 1-8-1. Now, Mr. Wilka took me to task in his brief, of course I didn't get a chance to reply, for suggesting that that was constitutionally derived power of the Secretary of State. I submit that it is, and was, because the previous Constitution, in spelling out the powers and duties of the other non-gubernatorial officials of our state, the Lieutenant Governor, the Secretary of State, and I believe the Treasurer, stated the Secretary of State's duties shall be set forth by statute. Well, they were subsequently set forth in 1-8-1. They haven't changed. And that little provision in the Constitution dissipated, evaporated, because it was no longer necessary. The Secretary of State's duties are there. But if you look at the Constitution, you'll find that when we're talking about the other non-gubernatorial personnel, it says in the heading there, I can't remember exactly what it says, but it's followed by powers and duties, and then it doesn't list any powers and duties. So I guess what I'm saying is 1-8-1 are the powers and duties constitutionally derived of the Secretary of State. They never changed. The governor had to do that before 1972 and had to do it after.
2 minutes.
Now, the trial court had an option here. It could infer that there was this power to keep pardons secret, or it could infer accountability. Now, the only case really that's on point that any of us found was Doe versus Salmon, which is a Supreme Court case in Vermont. Very similar to this case, very, very similar. The only difference, and this is the distinguishing point for the trial court, was that in Doe versus Salmon, which said you're not going to keep these pardons a secret in Vermont, they had a specific constitutional provision that went above and beyond ours. It not only said that the power is vested in the people, but it also went on to say, and the elected officials are legally accountable to the people. We don't have that legally accountable to the people phrase in our Constitution. I'm here to submit that if the trial court was to infer anything in South Dakota, it is that the government is accountable to the people. Pardons that are secret does not create an accountable representative. There's no place for that. If there's to be any inference in this state, I would hope that we would be inferring accountability. I will leave you with a very short anecdote that I think is illustrative of what we're saying. There's been no usurpation of power in this case. The governor has absolute discretion. We're simply saying you got to tell us what you're doing. We can't affect how you're doing it, but you just have to tell us what you're doing. I had a friend who walked in on me Friday. I said, I'm trying to figure out what to say after a year. I've got to condense this to 5 minutes. Really, shouldn't you have a right to know that the governor pardoned members of his family or friends? Or he said he did. I said, I don't know. I don't mean it that way, but I don't know, and maybe I should.
You're not contesting, then, the legality of the pardons?
Not at all. I'm simply saying that we ought to know who got pardoned.
All right, as far as you're concerned, you've got 279 valid pardons in that drawer at the Secretary of State.
A governor, and I don't mean to pick on a governor could pardon his friends, he could pardon his fellow, he could pardon the person who raped my daughter and not tell me about it, no, but he certainly could pardon that person.
Now, what, are you asking just for a release of the names, or I don't know what's in those files either,
file. That's why it's sort of a mystery, I'm kind of groping, but I would think that whatever had to be recorded in the past, which is the grant of pardon, I don't think there's anything more in those grants than the names. But that's really what we're looking for. And I think that that's the accountability factor. Without it, there is no accountability.
Thank you. Your time has expired, Mr.
Thank
Harrison.
Thank you. Again, I'm sorry for being late.
Mr. Walker.
May it please the court, Mr. Attorney General Long, Mr. Hallam, and Mr. Arneson. What I heard the Attorney General say, much of what I heard him say, I agree with. We have no factual disputes in this case. I don't think we even have a dispute about the proper standard of review. I think it's strictly de novo here. Judge Severson entered a ruling where he interpreted a constitutional provision and a lot of law which surrounds the issue of pardons. What we do disagree about is the impact of the history of our state constitution. And I also hear the attorney for the amicus argue about what they think the law should be. What should be the law about the sealing or unsealing of pardons. And what Judge Severson decided was not what the law should be, but what the law is. And that's what courts are supposed to do. If, in fact, the majority of the people feel that pardons should not be sealed, they have the opportunity to have a constitutional amendment passed and voted on by the majority of the people. And that's exactly what happened in 1972 that made a fundamental change in our state constitution, particularly with respect to the power of the governor. Prior to 1972, there had been a long history of a campaign for constitutional revision, a campaign that was actually centered at this university because one of the biggest proponents of this constitutional revision commission was Dr. William Farber. And I remember, as a student here, many of the discussions about the need for constitutional revision, and one of the primary needs was that at that time the thinking was the governor is not strong enough. Now, with the passage of 30 years since then, for many people that may sound like an impossible or untenable situation because we've had strong governors in the meantime. But that was the reason for that constitutional change, and the change which was effected involving many powers of the governor actually changed dramatically the power to pardon. Not but the power to grant pardons.
This historical record, once the constitutional amendment comes in 72, they don't start sealing the pardons right away, do they?
No, they didn't.
Do you have any explanation for that?
No, I've found nothing on it, and I've done a lot of reading about that, Your Honor. Governor Knaip, as far as I know, did not seal any pardons. The only information we have on that is the affidavit by the Secretary of State where he went back and reviewed the records he had. But simply because the governors from 1972 to 1984 did not seal pardons does not contradict the position we have, because it is our position that with the plenary power that the governor has under the state constitution, Article 4, Section 3, the governor can seal or unseal any pardons as he sees fit.
Then why, when they sealed those pardons, did the governor write sealed pursuant to SDCL 24-1811?
I don't know why he did that. Perhaps he underestimated the authority that the Constitution gave him, or perhaps whoever drafted the first order made an error, and that error just followed the orders that were followed after that. But that's similar to the analysis that this court made in State v. Oban, where the court, in its order, referred to the wrong statute for purposes of suspending a portion of a sentence. The court did not reverse for that reason, but instead inferred and assumed that the judge was referring to another statute that clearly did give him the power. We also have many decisions where this court has affirmed circuit judges for making the correct decision, even if for the wrong reason. And so whether or not the apprehension by the governor at that time was correct or incorrect, whether or not he thought he needed the authority from that statute, the history of Article 4, Section 3 suggests otherwise. In fact, I think mandates otherwise. Up until that point, the governor could not pardon for treason. He could only do so with the recommendations from the board. The recommendations with reasons had to be filed with the Secretary of State, and each year the governor had to report to the legislature the name, crime, sentence, date, and date of pardon. All of that was imposed upon the governor constitutionally up until 1972. Then the 72 amendments were passed by a popular vote of the people, and all of those restrictions were eliminated. The only restriction that remained is that he could not pardon for conviction of impeachment.
Mr. Wolka, now the provision does not say anything about sealing or not sealing. It's really silent on that. If we rule, as you're suggesting, that the plenary power of the governor gives him the power to decide whether to seal pardons or not, what wide effect might that have on other powers that the executive branch has? Are we then saying that there are other provisions that give him power that he can also seal and keep private from the public?
No, Your Honor. I think that the decision would be limited to this context, because it is in this context of the history of the requirements that the governor report to the legislature, for example, and only act upon recommendations with respect to pardons which was so dramatically changed. I don't know of any other instances where we have that sort of dramatic historical change. But another point that your question raises is the idea that because records are held by public officials makes them publicly accessible is just wrong. This court just issued another rule for the UJS records where you listed 26 types of court records that the public generally does not have access to. In my brief, I cited 18 examples of public records, records submitted to and held by state agencies that as a matter of statute are not public. So it's not true that simply because a record is held by a public official such as the Secretary of State that that means that everybody in the world has access to it, nor is it necessary that be the case. And in our position is, as adopted by Judge Severson, that for the legislature to infringe upon the governor's power, not only to determine who gets pardoned, but how he is going to conduct himself in the exercise of that power, which would include sealing the records, that for the legislature to try to limit that is a violation of the separation of powers doctrine. And when you look at the change in the Constitution and some of the authority of this case, for example, South Dakota Automobile Club versus Volk specifically says that usually amendments are adopted for the express purpose of making a change in the existing system.
What's the point of even walking them down to the Secretary of State's office from the governor's office and filing them in? Why are they there?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor, there are records in many other state agencies which are not public. They're not all kept in one place. If the statute requires that there be a seal of the Secretary of State, perhaps that's historically why they were always filed with the Secretary of State.
Okay.
The amicus brief also argues that there's a First Amendment right of access here. And as we made the point in our brief, the granting of a pardon is fundamentally different than the types of proceedings that have been the subject of all of those First Amendment cases, whether we're talking about judicial proceedings or administrative proceedings that are quasi-judicial. Because when a person applies for a pardon, the person has no right to that pardon. The person has no due process rights surrounding that pardon application. He has no right to know who the governor talked to about him, why the governor did what he did in granting or denying it, who opposed it, or any other reasons that went into it.
But he has the right not to ask for a pardon, doesn't he? I mean, he's committed a crime, theoretically, and that's a public record, and he has the right not to ask for a pardon if he's afraid it's going to become public.
Yes. But the pardons that are at issue in this case were pardons that were sealed. People received them with an order that simultaneously advised them that this record is going to be sealed. And some of these go back many years. People have gone on with their lives with a governor's order saying, your past is behind you and it is going to be sealed, and now many years have passed since these orders have been entered. If Governor Rounds tomorrow wants to enter a pardon and not seal the records, that's totally within his prerogative under our interpretation of Article 4, Section 3.
Are you saying that at least as to your four clients, they applied for, requested a pardon on the condition that it would be sealed, but not otherwise?
I can't say that about all of them, Judge.
There's nothing in the record to prove it anyway, is there?
No, there isn't. And I wouldn't know that about all of those people, that they applied for it on condition that it would be sealed. But after the receipt of it, on the strength of an order saying that it had been sealed, they have, in fact, moved on with the rest of their lives.
Is your argument logical when the underlying criminal conviction, except for suspended impositions of sentence, which are sealed, the rest of them are public record, the underlying convictions, aren't they?
Yes, but
wouldn't you want the public to know, hey, I've been pardoned?
Some people might Some people, in fact, have, during all of the publicity surrounding this case, have come out and talked to the paper, said they were pardoned. But to me, that's an individual choice. I mean, it's if somebody wants to divulge what otherwise he would have a right to confidentiality about, just like our clients can go tell people about our private lawyer-client conversations with them. We can't, but they can if they so choose. But the suspended imposition of sentence, I think, is a very good example, Your Honor, where that is the example of judicial clemency, where the courts have the power to say, we are going to give you a break. We are going to give you the opportunity to put this part of your life behind you, and that record is sealed after the period of probation has been satisfied.
But that's by statute. That is set forth in statute.
Yes, it is, but the authority for that is also in the Constitution. And I think it had to come from a constitutional change, as I recall it, because historically, even in the era when there were these restrictions on what the governor had to do after he granted a pardon in terms of reporting it, even back, State ex rel. Anderson, a case we cited in our brief from the 1920s, talked about how the power to pardon was so exclusively the domain of the executive. After that, the Constitution was amended to provide the power for the courts to suspend imposition of sentence, because it is in the nature of clemency, I believe was the rationale of some of those decisions. So that the bottom line here for Judge Severson, as he described in his memorandum opinion, and I hope for this court, is to determine what the law is. I don't think that what this case is about is to determine what's the best way to run our system in terms of should these pardons be secret or shouldn't they. That's a normative question that should be decided by the people if, in fact, the majority think that the process of sealing is inappropriate. But because of the decision that was made in 1972 to repose all of this power in the executive department, that's what the law is.
So the legislature, under your theory, if we ruled it in your favor and they did not like it, would be constitutionally powerless to reverse that. It would take an amendment to the South Dakota Constitution, correct?
Yes, that would be the remedy, would be a constitutional amendment, not simply some legislation, which if such legislation was passed, that would be a violation of the separation of powers doctrine, because it would then be infringing constitutionally upon the prerogative of this court. All branches of government have inherent power. And of course, we have many cases talking about the inherent power of the judiciary. Certainly, we have cases about the inherent power of the legislature and the executive. And it's our position that the governor has the inherent power to decide how he is going to conduct his use of this pardoning power. The cases that Mr. Long described, particularly the Noonan case, the federal case, was an example of a litigant saying, I have a right to have my record expunged, even though the executive, the president in that case, granting the pardon, had not entered an order expunging it. The litigant was saying, I have a right to enforce that on my own. And I disagree with that. I agree with the holding in that case, because under our reading of the Constitution as it exists today, the applicant does not have a right to go to the governor and say, you must seal my record. It is totally the prerogative and the discretion of the governor.
So the basis of your argument, if I'm understanding it, is that when this was changed in 1972 and that language was taken out, the additional language about reporting it to the legislature and so forth, that at that point would have been then when the people of South Dakota would have given this power to the governor.
Yes, Your Honor. That's exactly when.
And it's a interpretation, kind of a statutory interpretation that we would have to look at in order to draw that conclusion. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. And there, this court's lengthy discussion about how you review the history of the Constitution constitutional amendments that are proposed, even constitutional amendments proposed and rejected, the lengthy discussion that we have of that in Poppin v. Walker, I submit, weighs heavily in favor of the conclusion that Judge Severson drew here, and that is that when you look at that history and all of this information about pardons had to be reported, had to be public constitutionally, could only be granted upon recommendations, when the constitutional revision takes all of that out of there, we cannot ignore that history under Poppin v. Walker, and the conclusion is the people wanted the executive to have the unfettered power to decide how he was going to conduct his affairs regarding pardons.
How does the power to seal or open affect the governor's unfettered power to pardon?
It doesn't. I would argue, Your Honor, that goes with it. If the governor did not have the power to seal pardons, he would still have what we would describe as the unfettered power to decide who gets pardoned and who doesn't, and what kinds of crimes he's going to grant pardons for and which not, and you know, perhaps I'll pardon people from this county and not from that county. I mean, he would have that power even without the power to seal. But our argument is that when you look at the history, that power to seal pardons is part of the governor's total discretionary power on how to conduct the pardoning function.
Do you really think, though, let's look at 1972 for a minute, that the people intended to give the governor carte blanche power over pardons? 1972 is the year of Watergate and President Nixon. I mean, the whole country's talking about executive power, abuse of executive power, and you see the citizens of the state of South Dakota deciding to place all the power in the hands of the governor to the exclusion of the judiciary and the legislature.
Well, Your Honor, I have two responses to that. First of all, the massive public outcry about the distrust of the use of executive power really didn't happen until 1973. 1972, President Nixon won by a landslide, and nobody was really paying much attention to the use of his power or abuse of his power at that time. A year later, it was a big issue. Whether or not that had any impact on the voters of South Dakota when they were voting for this constitutional proposal, I don't know. But the other part of the response is that in order to interpret the organic law of the Constitution, the court looks at the history of the organic law, not all kinds of peripheral things that may have been going on at the same time in history. So whether or not one could at this time go back, say, and take a poll of everybody who voted at that time would not be a proper way of interpreting what the law is. If we could even find them, and if they even remembered why they voted. If you look at, and I did, look at, for example, the editorials endorsing this constitutional change, there's no discussion of pardons in there. There was discussion of many other things, and the fundamental purpose was to give our governor a lot more power and the ability to run the executive branch. This came along with it.
Any further questions from the bench?
I have one question. You cited the Poppin versus Walker, but to me, the Poppin versus Walker is a South Dakota lottery case where the Constitution provided certain exemptions or say gambling permitted in Deadwood for historic purposes and so forth. And that was the only purpose for which gambling was permitted in the state of South Dakota. And yet the legislature came along and thought they could override the Constitution by enacting a video lottery. And so I don't see that, you know, it's to me that's a completely different case than what you're arguing here, because there the Constitution, you know, clearly provided only certain ways that you could have gambling in the state of South Dakota. And the legislature then, after the case was decided by this court, obviously came up with an amendment that they took to the people. And then it was voted back in as a constitutional method.
And that's exactly what I think would have to be done here, would be a constitutional amendment if people don't like this ceiling. But the reason why I suggest, Your Honor, that Poppin v. Walker is good authority supporting Judge Severson's decision is that when the court was trying to decide in that case whether video lottery fit within the definition of lottery that was in the Constitution, the court looked at the history of the constitutional amendments leading up to that, including constitutional amendment proposals which were rejected. And one of those rejected, I believe specifically referred to something called video poker. And because that proposal was rejected, the court concluded that as a matter of constitutional history, video lottery didn't fit within the definition of lottery, which was the only word in the Constitution.
Your time expired before the question. I've let you go on and on.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Do you get a fair answer?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Attorney General, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me briefly make a couple points. I don't agree with the statement that each branch of government has plenary power. I don't think the judiciary has plenary power. I don't think the governor has plenary power. I think that the teachings of this court hold that only the legislature has plenary power. The Constitution limits what the legislature can do, and the legislature can do whatever they want unless they are specifically prohibited from doing so by the Constitution. Powers to the judiciary and powers to the governor are delegated powers. And I think that's a fundamental disagreement between me and Mr. Gwilka. Having said that, Mr. Gwilka indicated in his brief, time and time again, situations where documents which are held by government have been declared by the legislature to be confidential, not by the governor. The sealing of those records, or the holding of those records time after time, as Mr. Wilkham noted, were decisions made by the legislature, not by the governor, even though many of those documents are held by the executive, and even though if the governor has plenary power, supposedly, he would be able to seal some of those records.
For the benefit of...
That makes no sense.
For the benefit of the audience, and maybe for the court, would you define what you mean by plenary power?
Well, I think that's a word which is used loosely, but I think plenary power is exclusive power, and I think that's the context in which it was used by the trial court. And to the extent that the governor has exclusive power which encompasses the ability to seal the records, I disagree with that.
You're saying the governor has no plenary power to seal the records, but the legislature would have the plenary power to do that.
I believe so. If there is plenary power at all, it's reposited in the legislature, not the governor and not the courts. Now, let me go back to my original point, though. Someone has to decide what the voters of South Dakota meant when they put the word pardon in the Constitution and granted the ability to give pardons to the governor, because I do not believe that the governor gets to decide that. I believe this court, or the trial court, should have and did not, and I believe it's incumbent upon this court to define that term. And with that in mind, let me throw out a couple of examples. Let's assume that the court follows the ruling of the trial court. Does that mean then that Governor Rounds can unseal the pardons that have already been sealed by a prior court or by a prior governor? Certainly the legislature can't stop him from doing that. And according to the trial court, the court can't stop him from doing that. And there's no due process right involved in that issue, because the granting of a pardon is an act of clemency, and there are no due process or equal protection rights that attach to that. Now, can the governor say, these records will be open on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and not open on Tuesdays and Thursdays? Can he open the records for people whose names start with L, and not for people whose names start with W?
I mean, is that what the voters of South Dakota really intended? Is that what they meant when they said the governor can grant pardons? We will concede, and we have always conceded, that the governor can grant a pardon to anybody he wants to, anytime, under any circumstances. But sealing of the records is beyond his power. That's a power which is reposited in the legislature. And it's the legislature who gets to decide whether records are sealed or records are not sealed. Even when the court was enacting the rule that the court dealt with in terms of judicial records, the vast bulk of those determinations were based on statute, which the legislature made the determination that a particular court record would be sealed or a particular court record would not be sealed. I don't think that the voters of South Dakota believed that they were ever repositing with the governor the ability to decide which pardons are public and which pardons are not, and be able to reverse himself and change that, which I think is the logical extension of the trial court's ruling. Thank you for your time, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.